from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in College Station, Texas. A 19-year-old woman pulled into a parking lot. She parked in a handicap space. Someone nearby noticed and thought it was strange that someone who appeared to be fully physically fit would be using such a spot. According to KAGS News in Texas, the woman was Taylor Williams, the 19-year-old. She went into Target to shop. And the couple who noticed her parking in the handicap spot went in and found her in the store and started yelling at her. They said, "How dare you park in a handicap spot? You're clearly not disabled." But they had no idea what Taylor has been through. Taylor might appear able-bodied and typically capable, but she struggles with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. That's a rare disorder which causes mutations to the collagen in her body. It affects her brain and her organs, her heart, lung, eyes, connective tissues, joints, everything. There are good days and bad, dozens of daily pills, all kinds of things. And since her disability isn't always outwardly visible, Taylor says she is sometimes harassed, which was the case when she visited her local Target. But she says it's situations like this that drive her to continue educating others on her own condition. She says, "I could have it a lot worse, and other people do, so I have to live with what I'm given and be an advocate for people like me." I thought that was inspiring because this hour we're having a conversation about not only disability, it's the dialogue on disability, but what can appear to be sort of invisible disability or at least misunderstood. Everything from MS to so many other conditions and challenges people face. And what we want to talk about are individual experiences, how we can understand them better, and understand the resources in our community. Let me go ahead and welcome our guests. Carrie Giesen is a volunteer and client of the National MS Society Upstate New York Chapter. Carrie, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Randy Havens is a volunteer for Epilepsy Prelude, Inc., and I guess a former client, fair to say?
Yeah, that's about right.
All right,
yeah.
Very good to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And Mike Riddell is Education Coordinator and Camp Eager Director for Epilepsy Prelude. Mike, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, that story out of Texas grabbed me just because I think it's easy for us to judge, Mike. And, you know, what do you make of stories like that where I think a couple might feel like they're doing the right thing, saying, "Hey, those spots are reserved for people who, quote unquote, need them." But sometimes when we see somebody for 10 seconds in a store or in a parking lot, we might not know their full story.
Sure. Like in the case of epilepsy, if someone's actually having a seizure, it's pretty recognizable. But if they're not, they look like anybody else. And so when you go into a store or when you go anywhere out in the community, you know, it's hard to tell whether that person has a disability and also some of the things that they're coping with in their everyday life.
Now, when you were younger, you experienced seizures yourself?
I did. I was diagnosed as a teenager with epilepsy, and I had nocturnal seizures, so all my seizures happened at night, but it was a tonic-clonic seizure disorder. So I had several different seizures, which caused my body to get very rigid and very stiff and have convulsions. But a lot of people don't realize that there's a lot of different types of seizures that people can have, into the tune of 20 different types of seizures. So you can have an absence seizure where you just kind of stare off into space, or a complex partial seizure, which causes you to do different types of activities, but you're not convulsing, so it doesn't look like a seizure. And that's where people are misunderstood a lot of times with that.
I think we hear the word seizure and we have one image of one physical event, as opposed to the diversity of things that could mean. And for you, when those seizures started happening, they were nocturnal, but do you have recollection of them? Did they wake you up? Were you aware of what was going on?
I certainly knew that they happened. I don't remember anything that happened during the seizure. Like a lot of times people who have generalized seizures, their awareness is affected. The after effects, or the postictal period, they call it, is the period of recovery when someone has a seizure. And sometimes that takes a little while for them to get back to 100%. But they may know that something happened. They just don't know exactly what during the event.
Was it frightening for you?
Sure. First of all, you know, waking up from having a seizure and having everybody look at you and mm-hmm. wondering, you know, concerned for you, and you have no idea why they're concerned. But, you know, knowing that the biggest challenge for me was I didn't know when the seizures were coming. They could happen any time of the day or night. And so, you know, going to bed at night, not knowing if you're going to have a seizure that night, that was very frustrating and difficult.
What were the, I was going to use the word after effects. You called it, what was the period after the seizure?
The period of recovery after the seizure is called postictal.
And what does that feel like physically? What is that like?
You're exhausted. You're physically exhausted. You're sore. Again, this depends on the type of seizure mm-hmm. you had. But a lot of times it takes some people quite a long time to get back to 100%. So you just need some rest, and time will, again, make everything better.
Is there, you know, as you grow up and you're, you know, become more fluent in understanding your own challenges with it, is there any concern that others who don't understand might judge that, oh, this person has seizures? Again, knowing that a lot of people have one idea for what that means, what that looks like, if there's stigma attached to it.
Sure. With a lot of disabilities, there's a stigma attached to, you know, each different type of disability and what the preconceived notion is on that disability. So with epilepsy, you know, people have said, oh, they're going to swallow their tongue during a seizure, or their eyes roll in the back of their head. That's not true. You can't really, or foaming at the mouth, things like that. You know, but individuals who have seizures, they contribute a lot to their community, and they're very smart individuals. They just happen to have a little bit of seizure activity happening, and it causes a lack of awareness or a very short period of time where they're involved with a seizure. And then eventually they, you know, come out of the seizure and they're fine. But people don't understand that in the community. They don't, a lot of times people don't understand that. Again, the big barrier too with seizures is they look vastly different in everybody who has them.
Well, there's some news out of Rutgers University just a few days ago, earlier this week, in which Rutgers scientists tried to shed some light on the link between epilepsy and depression, which has been the subject of speculation for many, many years. They say that epilepsy and depression may share a genetic cause, and Rutgers scientists discovered that individuals with one form of the epilepsy are more likely to suffer from depression. They say that those mood disorders are under-recognized and under-treated in people with epilepsy. What do you make of that?
Well, people who have epilepsy, sometimes there are barriers to everyday life. Transportation. If you have seizure disorder, you can't drive, you know, having active seizures. Sometimes employment gets in the way, you know, being able to provide for yourself and your family. So a lot of times people suffer from, you know, low self-esteem or confidence issues because they can't get around as easy as everybody else, or they can't get gainful employment if their seizures are too frequent. There's a lot of people in the world who are able to access transportation and to be gainfully employed. But for a majority or a certain percentage of the people who have epilepsy, they can't. And that could lead to severe depression or anxieties and things like that.
A little bit more of the news out there, by the out of Rutgers, by the way. Nationwide, 3.4 million Americans have active epilepsy, having been diagnosed and regularly treated for the disease, including 470,000 children. That's according to data from the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Other research has shown epilepsy can run in some families, but more work is needed to determine what genes are involved or how these could also connect to depression or other mood disorders. So when people ask you, is it genetic? What do you say?
It could be. There's a lot of reasons why someone could have epilepsy. It could be from a brain injury or an illness that someone had, meningitis or lead poisoning even. It could be genetic as well. So 70% of the people who have epilepsy, the cause is unknown. So for 30%, there was an identifiable cause there. There was some type of injury to the brain or things like that. So it's also very frustrating if you don't know the cause. You don't know why me, why this happened to me type of thing.
Okay, well, let me ask our other guests to kind of share their experiences. And Randy Havens is a former program participant at Epilepsy Prelude and living with epilepsy. Tell me a little bit, take me back to when you knew your diagnosis and what you understood about it.
Well, actually, I'm quite different than most people that that have been diagnosed with epilepsy. I actually, I was born with epilepsy. And according to most of the doctors that I've talked to, that's actually pretty rare case. So my first seizure was actually just moments after I was born, which obviously is was quite upsetting for my parents. You know, they have this brand new baby that you know, suddenly is already having issues. But it kind of led to I kind of developed a little bit differently as far as, like, a lot of people when they go through. When they get the diagnosis, they kind of go through a why me period, like Mike was talking about. Mm-hmm. And with me, you know, because it was always a part of me, I didn't really go through that kind of thing. It was just a part of who I was. You know, my parents told me that, you know, you have seizures occasionally, and, you know, it's something you're going to have to deal with. And they always told me to make sure that my teachers and my coaches, they all knew that I had epilepsy in case something happened during class or during a practice, then they could kind of educate themselves as to how to take care of that scenario.
Can I ask, when you were younger, how frequent, and has it been consistent?
It was fairly frequent when I was really young, and my mom actually has told me stories about when I was, you know, an infant, and she said that when I was an infant, if I had one seizure, I would have three. So I would have them in the middle of the night sometimes as well, and she would actually, you know, she'd hear me like moving around in my crib or whatever, and she'd wake up and come take care of it. And she said she would actually wait until after I had three in order to go back to bed. Wow. And I guess that was fairly frequent. And as I got older, they became a little bit less and less frequent. And I was on the same medicine for most of my life, probably from when I was about 5 years old or so, up until I was about 25. I was on the same medicine, which was called Tegretol, and it did a fairly good job of controlling it as long as I remembered to take the medicine. And you know, they'd have to increase my dosage every couple of years as I grew and whatnot to make sure that I was getting enough medicine into my body to keep that control. But they definitely, you know, I only had one or two throughout all of my like high school years. And only one in college, and actually at this point it's been 12 years since my last seizure, and a little over 2 years ago they took me off of my medicine, and I've still been seizure free since coming off of the medicine. So.
12 years since your last seizure.
Yep.
Is that amazing to you? I mean, like, do you think I didn't know if I was going to have a life without seizures?
Honestly, yeah. The last seizure that I did have, I was about 20 years old, and I went into my neurologist's office, you know, talked to him about after it happened and tell him, you know, what happened and all, you know, all kinds of stuff. At the time, they were trying to take me off of my meds because you can actually stop having seizures like I have now. It had been, I think, 3 years at that point since my previous seizure. So they wanted to take me off of the meds, see what would happen. And about a month or two later, I had another seizure, went back into the doctor's office, and he actually told me at that point, you're most likely going to be on medicine for the rest of your life. You know, he said there's, you know, at this point, your chances of not having seizures anymore is very slim. So you're probably going to be taking medicine for the rest of your life. And that was pretty discouraging, actually. You know, I was 20 years old, and I was, you know, kind of looking forward to not having to take medicine every morning and every night at some point in my life. And he kind of took that away from me. But then 10 years later, I finally actually got to that point that, you know, they tried it again, and here I am 2 years later without medicine.
All right, so what is it that changed from age 20 to 30 for them to say, yeah, this, you don't even need medicine anymore?
It was basically that I hadn't had a seizure in that whole time period. And they did some more tests. We did an MRI. We did some more EEGs. And an EEG, you basically have to have a seizure while you're in the EEG in order to really get too much information from it. But at the time, there's another diagnosis that they call it non-epileptic seizures, and they kind of present as seizures, but they're more of they're caused by stress and anxiety, and it's kind of a physical manifestation of mental anxiety and whatnot. And at the time, I was experiencing those, and I had a couple of those events while I was attached to the EEG, and they didn't see any activity on the EEG. So that's when they determined these aren't really seizures. And since it's been 10 years since your last neurological seizure, we can attempt to come off of the medicine now if you want. And at that point, I pretty much told them, I said, you know, you're saying these events are caused by stress and anxiety. And if I come off of the medicine now, it's going to cause me more stress and anxiety. So I didn't really think that was a great idea at the time. But then a couple months later, I got that under control, and it had been a few months since I had any sort of the non-epileptic events, as they call them. I was starting to feel some new side effects from medicine. Mm-hmm. So I basically said to them, hey, you know, I'm seeing these side effects. You said that I can try to come off of the medicine, and I think I'm comfortable with doing that now. So let's go ahead and see what we can do. And honestly, that was a very scary process. You know, I know what it's like to have a seizure, and I've had many of them throughout my life. And, you know, now I'm almost 30 years old, and I've got my license because, you know, I've been seizure free for 10 years. And so if I have another seizure at this point, I'm going to lose my license. You know, I'm going to have to go back onto the medicine. A whole lot of things are going to change. I might not be in a safe place when I have the seizure. So, you know, you never know what's going to happen when the seizure occurs, if it occurs. So it was very scary because, you know, there's always that chance that it's going to, you know, I'm going to come off the medicine and I'm going to have another seizure. So luckily that didn't happen, but
amazing.
Yeah.
That's thrilling to hear. And you know, just the idea of sort of outgrowing it, right?
Yeah, basically.
Wow. Mike, what do you make of that story? I mean, that's I don't hear too many stories quite like this one from Randy.
No, Randy's very unique. But there's a lot of individuals who have seizures for a period of their life, and then whether something works, the treatment works, and then the seizures go away. That's the best case scenario. Sometimes individuals that we work with, kids, adults, they have these seizures and they just can't get that seizure control. And when I say seizure control, I mean no seizures. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, because a seizure is a symptom of epilepsy. And if you're not having seizures, you know, your epilepsy is well under control. So we provide education and we have services to help these individuals, even though they're going to have these seizures for their long haul. Sometimes, you know, a seizure may come once a week or once a month, or, you know, we have some individuals that I know that we have at our camp or in our support group, they're having 60, 70 seizures a day, you know, and again, it depends on the type of seizure that they're having. The tonic-clonic, what we a lal of times people recognize as a grand mal seizure, that usually doesn't happen that frequently, but you have these absent seizures or what we used to call petty mal seizures that can happen many, many times a day and very, you know, impact that individual daily. And sometimes the neurologists work really hard to try to get a treatment, whether it's medication or diet, even sometimes surgery to put these seizures at bay, but sometimes it's not successful. And that individual will, you know, live their life with seizures on a pretty regular basis.
Sure. So, Randy, do you have any fear, any residual fear that they'll come back? Are you largely now not even thinking about it?
Yeah, at this point, you know, again, I've been off the medicine completely for over 2 years, so I'm pretty confident that, you know, it's not something that I have to worry about, at least, you know, anytime in the near future. And hopefully it won't return as I get older. But yeah, at this point, I'm pretty confident.
Yeah, that's great.
I'm in a good point.
Yeah, so. I mean, I'm somebody who lives with migraines some days, some weeks, some years more than others. But I keep wondering, you know, do you outgrow this? Do they eventually just go away? They sort of did for my mother, and sometimes they do. But it's inspiring to hear that is your story. But I also know that's not the story for everybody, and that's why, you know, you need volunteers. You need resources, you need help, because not everyone's going to have Randy's story. So you volunteer. Tell me about what you do.
I do a whole lot of stuff, actually. Anytime Mike needs a volunteer, most of the time I'm one of the first ones that he calls. So the camp that he's been talking about, I've been going to camp since the second year that it actually existed. And at that time, I was 8 years old. I was I was attending as a camper. And then we go through a process of going through what they call a CIT, a counselor in training. And so I did 2 years as a CIT, and ever since I turned 18, I've been returning as a counselor. So it's something that I look forward to every summer. I go to camp for a week, and I talk with the kids and keep them safe for the week, take care of their seizures, you know, make sure that they can basically be a normal kid for a week. And it's something that made a huge difference in my life. So I try to make sure that the kids, you know, have the same kind of experience that I did.
Tell me a little bit more about camp.
Well, camp is a wonderful place for individuals to go. We have two camps, actually, Camp Eager and another camp called Camp Coast. It happens simultaneously in the same week in August. And it's a 7-day residential camp for individuals who have epilepsy, and they get to come and be kids and do the stuff that kids of that age should do swim and rock. Climb on the rock wall and canoe and things like that, but they have the supervision from folks like Randy to come and do that. That's in August, but Randy also volunteers at our chocolate ball. We have a chocolate ball coming up February 3rd at the Hyatt, it benefits epilepsy-specific services like camp and support group and a teen weekend. We have a teen weekend for teenagers coping with the disability of epilepsy and trying to figure out ways around it. So there's lots of things that Randy does and a lot of other folks do for our agency to spread the awareness and give the education about epilepsy. Mm. But the camp is a great place. You know, they make lifelong friends at this camp and go and just do some kid stuff, you know, and have fun.
I want to answer a couple quick questions from the audience. One of our listeners heard the opening story. We talked about the woman, 19-year-old woman, Taylor Williams, in Texas, who was followed into a store and told she couldn't park in a handicapped spot because surely she couldn't have a disability, and she did. Someone asked if she had a handicap placard. The answer is yes, she did. But sometimes it's just easy to see someone get up out of a car and say, wait, that person shouldn't be in the handicapped spot. In the same way that, well, think about this, according to the BBC, 1 billion people worldwide live with some kind of a disability. 1 billion with the B. That's according to the World Health Organization. And a U.S. survey found that 74% of those with disabilities don't use a wheelchair or anything else that might visually signal their impairment to the outside world. Obviously not everybody, but Mike, I think it's probably important to point out that I don't always know everything about you, and I want to learn, you know, and I want to learn what your struggles can be, and I want to not make you feel like whatever you're living with is a stigma, would mean to cast it out. What would you say to those numbers, and especially that number that says, you know, 74%, you know, don't have sort of an outside signal to the world that there's a disability?
Well, that's what this hour is about, is the hidden disabilities, you know, and there's so many different disabilities that you couldn't tell if they're struggling with something by just walking or watching them walk down the street. If you happen to see me have a seizure, or if I told you that I had a seizure, then you'd know. But otherwise, you would never know. So there, I don't doubt those numbers at all. There's a lot of individuals worldwide who have these types of disorders or disabilities, and it's up to the public and the community to recognize the fact that what's not as visible to the naked eye, you know, there could be more issues or deeper than face value.
Now you're going to hear Carrie's story coming up in our second half hour. Randy, for you growing up, you know, living with seizures as you were, you're 5 years old, you're 7, you're 9 years old. I mean, these are ages where you want to be making friends, hanging out, having fun, but sometimes you might have to explain to a friend, you know, those kind of things. And kids who might not live with seizures or know what that means might be confused about that. What was it like socially for you growing up as you recall it?
It was very difficult at times because, you know, it's not something that, quote, normal kids have to experience, and it's not something that a lot of people are taught about. It's not something that people really know about. So, you know, I'd have to explain to them that, hey, you know, every once in a while, I might have a seizure, and there's not much that you can do about it, you know, and except for just make sure that I'm safe. And, you know, if there's an adult around, find an adult, and they can help you take care of it. But, you know, kids are mean. A lot of kids are very mean. And
if they don't understand, perhaps, right?
Yeah. And so, like, you know, my good friends that were real friends, they understood, and they kind of, you know, just like, okay, that's you. That's, you know, we accept that that's part of you. And then, you know, some people were not as accepting, and I just kind of kept my distance from the people that, mm-hmm. that weren't as nice about it. And you know, I made sure that my close friends were the ones that really understood and accepted it. And like actually, when I was in middle school, I was in seventh grade, I was in gym class, and there's a debate over whether or not I got hit in the head with a soccer ball. But regardless of what happened, I ended up having a seizure on the soccer field. And my friend Grant, who was one of my best friends at the time, he was going to lunch right after the gym period ended. And the lunchroom, you know, the cafeteria is right across the hall from the gym. And all these people are gathering around the gym. They're like, hey, what's going on? What's going on? You know, and, I'm getting loaded into an ambulance and everything. And Grant stops and says, hey, you know, what's up? Why has everybody stopped here? And somebody says, oh, Randy's out there. He's having a seizure. And Grant just, oh, okay. And he just kept going, because Grant knew that that's a normal thing. You know, that's something that happens to Randy. And then, you know, when I got home that evening, he talked to me and said, hey, you all right? You know, I heard you had a seizure. And, you know, but he didn't really treat it as anything different. And that's the kind of friends that I really got close with, you know, the people that understood that, you know, there's this thing that I have to deal with, and, you know, it's not something I can control, unfortunately. And, you know, if you accept it and you're willing to help me out with it, then it'll just make life better for both of us.
One of the strongest women I know, absolute powerhouse, runs marathons, pretty much was running marathons at 8 months pregnant, just this amazing mother of two, nonstop, super fit, also lives with seizures. And some people are surprised to find out, but that's just part of life for her. She's a powerhouse. And I wonder, Randy, then, if that experience for you, you think about Grant and his reaction was just like, oh, that's something that happens to Randy. You know, it can look a little scary, but that's something that happens to my friend. Do you support integrative education that helps, you know, students, campers, you know, who are for sort of neurotypical, pick whatever term you want, also to experience life with people with varying disabilities. So it's, you know, something that they are more accustomed to, that it doesn't become a stigma or an other.
Yeah, I definitely think that it would benefit to, you know, for the kids that I was around to know more about my epilepsy and to, you know, to integrate with other people that have other disorders or disabilities and basically learn as much as they can from those people. And, you know, some people, they look at some of the struggles that I went through as a kid and they just say, you know, you're that much stronger, because we all went through life without having to deal with that, and we still struggled through getting through some of life. And, you know, I've got this added thing that I got to deal with of, you know, every once in a while I have to deal with a seizure. And as you know, Mike mentioned the postictal stage after a seizure, and that can be really rough for some people. And for me, it most of the time it really was like extremely tough. So my parents would like keep me out of school the next day, and you know, I think understanding that kind of thing and being able to see somebody that's going through that and talk to them and learn from them, I think that's nothing but a positive experience.
Okay.
And that brings me to my point of the services that Epilepsy Prelude has at our agency. You know, I'm the education coordinator, so we go out to schools, businesses, agencies, and give that tool to faculty, staff, anybody who needs it, so that if and when they work with someone or live with someone who has epilepsy, they know what to do. And that awareness and that education is there. And I guess it's kind of job security for me, because there's a lot of people out there that need information about several different disabilities, but specifically epilepsy.
Jay on Twitter says, Evan, six words. Ironically, you can't see, I'm blind. I'm legally blind, but I don't use a cane or a dog, and I do ride a bike. And Jay's just saying, you know, some people are shocked to find out that guy who doesn't use typical, you know, helpful accoutrements that people who are blind usually wear have. But he said that's life, and that's part of what we're talking about this hour. And after our only break of the hour, we're going to come back and talk to Carrie Giesen, who is a volunteer with the National MS Society Upstate New York chapter and also a client, and we'll talk about her experiences as well. You're hearing Randy Havens, who's a volunteer of Epilepsy Prelude, Inc., and Mike Riddell, who is Education Coordinator and Camp Eager Director for Epilepsy Prelude. Let's get that only break of the hour and come right back with them. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So Carrie Giesen is a volunteer and a client of the National MS Society, the Upstate New York chapter. So pretty different story than Randy. But let's kind of go back to your own diagnosis. And why don't you take me to the beginning of your story?
Sure. So I had just moved here from Minnesota. My husband got a job with Kodak, so we moved out here in 1997. And in 1998, I was diagnosed with MS, so almost 20 years ago. In September of 1998, and I had gone out for a run after work and came home, and my arms and my hands and my legs and my feet were tingling, and I thought that was really odd. Once I cooled down, everything kind of went away. Thought that was odd, but it kept happening. So I figured I should probably go to the doctor, and after about a year of testing and everything, they finally, after the MRI, diagnosed me with MS. So that's how it was diagnosed.
What did you know about MS at the time?
Really nothing. My roommate that I lived with for about 8 years during college and afterwards, her sister has MS, and so I knew a little bit about it, but I really didn't know much about it. And at the time when I was diagnosed, I didn't want to know anything about it. I didn't want to go on the internet.
You didn't want to?
No, I didn't want to. I just shot myself right into denial and didn't really want to know much about it. But after a few years, I came around and really started educating myself on the disease.
So there was some early denial. Were you angry?
Yeah, I'm sure that was part of it. I think I was really afraid that I was going to be stuck in a wheelchair. And so I didn't really know how to react to it. And at the time, when I was diagnosed, there were only 3 medications that were out at the time. So it was just a disease that, you know, that I had just one picture of a person in a wheelchair, and I didn't really know, you know, much about it.
Where were you wrong? Where were you most wrong in your expectations?
Deal with everything, I think. So I'm in a wheelchair right now, and I couldn't have been more wrong. MS obviously has taken a lot from me and from my family and things that we're able to do. But with being in a wheelchair, I have the ability to do so much more. A lot of the same activities that I really like to do, like going shopping or going to museums, going to Europe, accepting the disease and accepting a wheelchair allowed for me to continue living life.
Interesting. So your expectation early on was, as soon as I accepted that wheelchair, my life I'm going to be more limited. But it was the opposite. It was, you know, once you accepted that, it would reopen some of what you love to do more.
Yeah, very much so. So I didn't really start experiencing noticeable symptoms until it was about 10 years into the disease. And that's when I had, obviously, the toughest time, because people noticed it. I had to explain myself. And it was tough. But once I accepted it myself and embraced the, you know, mobility devices that I needed, I was a much happier person.
And now you volunteer as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big change for you from the early years of just denying denying you had it at all.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me about volunteer work.
So I started volunteering about 5 years ago. And I walked into one of the people that I work with at the MS Society called and asked if I'd be interested in helping out with a social support group called Rams East that meets in Webster twice a month. And sure, why not? So I walked in, and there's about 20 people that are fed a hot lunch, and then they do an activity afterwards. And it can be anything from playing games to having a speaker come in to doing arts and crafts, anything to keep them engaged and entertained and everything. And that was my very first volunteer. And I'm actually co-leading that group now with a friend of mine who also has MS. And it's still going strong. But I've also, you know, done different things like lead self-help groups, and anytime they need someone to come and speak about MS on TV or radio, I love to do that, because I love to have people educated about the disease and what it involves. But my favorite thing that I got to do, which unfortunately isn't available for volunteers anymore, I was responsible for calling, following up with patients in upstate New York, people in upstate New York with MS that were either newly diagnosed or had, you know, had MS but we're calling in for questions and that kind of thing. And so I would follow up with those people and get to talk to them. And it was really, I loved it. I loved connecting with other people across the state that had MS and helping them make connections to what they, you know, what they need, whether it was to help them find a program to learn how to drive with hand controls, or you know, different neurologists in the area that they could go to, or different programs that are offered, you know, that were offered through the MS Society. So it was very, I really liked it. I was grateful that I could do that.
Carrie, Randy talked about having a birth diagnosis of epilepsy and what that meant growing up and navigating friends who understood and friends who didn't, and kids who could be supportive and kids who could be rather rough. You know, you were an adult with a diagnosis of MS. Did you have any concerns about what that meant for your circle of friends, your social life, what people would understand? Was there any anxiety there?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it would have been as much as a child when I was diagnosed. But yeah, I definitely did. And you know, I kind of sailed through MS for the first few years when my kids were little. And I'm very grateful for that, because I could still run after them and chase after them and participate in all the stuff that, you know, moms are supposed to do and volunteer at school and everything. So like I said, it was about 10 years after my diagnosis that it really started to affect me. But yeah, I was definitely worried, because a lot of my friends just don't know about MS and didn't know what it meant to have a relapse and how tired and you know, dysfunctional I could be during that time. So it was tough, but fortunately, I found a good set of friends.
And you certainly look like you're doing great now, but what would you love to go back and tell yourself 20 years ago? About, you know, what would be the advice that you'd go back now and say?
You're blowing things up in your head much worse than they really turn out to be.
And it's so hard not to.
I know it is. And yeah, so I miss out on a lot of things. You know, I wish I could wheel myself out onto the cross country, you know, grass and everything else to watch my daughter run. And I wish I could watch her ski right now. And unfortunately, my wheelchair doesn't do too well in snow. But so there's a lot of things that I wish that I could do that I miss out on. And that's just, you know, a few examples. But it's not nearly as bad as I had thought it was, you know, thought it was going to be. So, and I mainly suffer from, you know, my disability is physical, not cognitive. And so I know people with cognitive disabilities really, they're different with, you know, with their cognitive disability. So they suffer in a different way than people with a physical disabilities do, and they might have both. So that's one area where I'm very grateful, is that cognitively I haven't suffered. Although if you ask my kids.
That's every set of kids and their parents, Gary. That has nothing to do with your MS. You say you travel too.
Yeah.
I think one of the great points you're making is, of course you travel. Mm-hmm. You like to travel. So you have a wheelchair. So what?
Right.
Any additional challenges? I mean, do you remember the first trip you took, you know, with the wheelchair and how did it go?
So it's really hard traveling. I mean, you know, and I'm just talking about right now, almost 20 years later, it's really tough to travel because at home I have everything set up for what I need, you know, a handicapped accessible bathroom, a handicapped accessible car, all my mobility devices, everything that I need when I travel. You know, I always like to say my husband becomes my accessibility equipment because he's, you know, has to do a lot for me where there isn't a grab bar or such. So traveling does bring on some anxiety, and I've gotten better as I've done more traveling with my wheelchair. But you know, it's booking a hotel, and they say they have a handicapped accessible room. But do they know what handicapped? I mean, a lot of places say they're handicapped accessible, but really they're not. So then I have to got to call and make sure it's got, you know, a roll-in shower and everything that that I might need. So it's difficult, but you know what? It's completely doable to travel. I think you really have to have an open mind and just the ability to say, well, okay, if we get stuck in a situation, we'll make the best of it. And my husband and I went to Italy a few years ago, and I was in a wheelchair, and I couldn't have had a better time. And the Italian, you know, everything has to be retrofitted because obviously their buildings aren't new. But they, anywhere they could put in a ramp, they put in a ramp. They had individual bathrooms for people with disabilities and their caregiver. I couldn't have been treated better, and it was just wonderful.
Yeah. Where in Italy?
We started off, flew into Rome, went up to Florence, spent a few days there, rented a car, and drove around Tuscany, and then back to Florence and back down to Rome.
I'm thrilled to hear that because, having been to Tuscany, there are some really... it is old Europe. It's mm-hmm. old Europe is beautiful, mm-hmm. but it is not the grid American streets.
No.
It's got all kind of old character, but it would probably require some what we would call retrofitting or, mm-hmm. or updating. And mm-hmm. what you're saying is in plenty of places they've done that.
Oh yeah, tons. And I was incredibly impressed. And just the kindness of the people there, you know, if there was a huge step that I couldn't get up, you know, I had guys lifting me up onto the step to get into the restaurant. So
that's awesome.
I had a bit of a brain scramble from the cobblestones on my, going over the cobblestones with my wheelchair.
Yeah.
But it was fantastic. And when we were in Tuscany, I remember I made sure to book rooms that were, ground level. And the one hotel, we were in Volterra, and the hotel, she said, okay, the first floor isn't really the first floor. You'll go up a bunch of stairs and then another flight of stairs, and then that's the first floor. And I thought, well, okay, here we go, because I can't, I can't sit down here in the, waiting area for 2 days. So we just did it and then made sure that not to exhaust my energy by always going back to the, hotel during the day and stuff. So I really think it is possible. I mean, sometimes it's not going to be possible, but I think being as prepared as you can be before you leave for a trip and then having a good spirit about the whole thing is really worth it.
Well, here's a good lesson for anybody listening who runs a business, works at a place of business that has a sign or a mandate to be, quote, handicap accessible or wheelchair accessible. Carrie's raising a great point that those of us who don't use a wheelchair don't have to think about. Just because it mm-hmm. says that doesn't mean it really functionally is.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's tell everyone listening, if you want to claim to be handicap and wheelchair accessible, it means what?
I think, and I'm so amazed by this. I don't think businesses... including Wegmans, can I say that? I don't think they consult with people in wheelchairs.
Wegmans is a business. Why has Wegmans got like this extra ethereal plane? It's just a business.
I don't know. It's just a business. You're right.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I don't really think, from what I've seen, they have had wheelchair users come in and consult with them before they, like for Wegmans, what I'm going to say. The brand new, beautiful family bathroom that they have, I went into it and I was washing my hands. Going to wash my hands, but the soap was 5 feet away from where I needed it.
So unreachable.
I'm thinking, yeah, completely unreachable. So it's just little things like that. I wish businesses would consult with wheelchair users or people in walkers or, whatever. And in fact, my friends, I always take my friends with me when I go places because they make life easier for me. But I was at a restaurant that I really like, had to use the bathroom, and thankfully my friend came with me because going into the bathroom were two chairs and a big table in the way of getting to the handicap stall. So she had to, move everything for me so I could get through there. I got in the bathroom, which was huge, but they had like an eye and hook closure for a lock, and it was way up above that I couldn't reach it. So she kind of had to stand outside the door and hold it for me. So there are several places that claim to be handicapped accessible, and I think that's from the ADA. You have to have doors that you can go through and everything else, but they're really not. So I really wish that businesses would consult with people in wheelchairs first before they say we're handicapped accessible.
And Wegmans, if you're listening, we'll put you in touch with Carrie, and she will be your new consultant.
Yes, I would love that.
How's that?
Yeah, I would love it. Thank you.
I think that's such a good point, though, because I think a lot of people have good intentions, but mm-hmm. if you don't functionally really reach out and understand what someone's experience is,
mm-hmm.
you may have a ramp, but
yeah.
It's more complicated than
right.
that.
Right, exactly.
Very interesting. Carrie Gayson is a client of the National MS Society and a volunteer for them, the Upstate New York chapter. Where would you send people for information when they get that diagnosis? I mean, somebody listening today will eventually get that diagnosis. What would you tell them?
So the National Multiple Sclerosis Society's website is fantastic. www.nmss.org, and it contains so much information, and the important part is that it contains valid and accurate information. There is so much on the internet where you can, download or, go to a website that says you need to, do these crazy, ridiculous things and eat this kind of food to control your MS, and it's just, there's no research to prove that stuff. So to get the correct information, and it's accurate and valid, the National Multiple Sclerosis Society's website is definitely the best. And there's, their website is fantastic. There's tons of information on there.
There's a lot of research happening, and you know, when you search for MS research, you know, just an example, this is from also from January 8th, just a few days ago, study out of UCLA found that for multiple sclerosis, increasing cholesterol synthesis gene expression of the spinal cord can be a pathway to repair nerves that affect walking. It's early. It doesn't mean it's got all of the answers. And I'm wondering, as someone who lives with MS, do you learn not to sort of get too high and too low on research, or are you, do you follow that kind of stuff? Is it interesting to you?
Yeah, I definitely do. I love hearing about all the research that's coming out. But I now have, 20 years later, different expectations than I did when I was first diagnosed. I used to hang on every word of hearing, you know, anything on the news. Mm-hmm. Oh, they've developed this drug for MS. Not developed it, but it's in research. And now when I hear that, I know that it's, okay, 10 years away.
Yeah.
And once it becomes FDA approved, is it going to be, you know, what are the side effects, and what goes into taking that drug? And so my expectations are definitely different now, but to hear all of the exciting research that's being done is really great.
It's also true that the media doesn't always do the best job reporting on exactly what, what each trial means, because it's easy to get excited or get ahead of ourselves. It's a long process, and we all hope that eventually there are more horizons to be breached in the future with scientific research. Mike, how do you feel about that when it comes to scientific research out there and sort of the highs and lows? I mean, how close are you? Do you follow that kind of stuff?
Pretty closely, not only with the research, but as far as the legislation for people who have disabilities, and what laws are being passed to protect the rights of individuals with disabilities and the accommodations that are in place for people with certain types of disabilities. It's daunting as far as, you know, what we've done and where we have to go. There's a lot of research still to be done about treatment for not only epilepsy but other disorders and disabilities. It's an ongoing process. So anytime we can get in there and do some more research about each of these disabilities, the better.
We got a few minutes left with our guests here, so I'll ask Mike to sort of piggyback off some of what Carrie Giesen was saying, just about understanding, you know, for her with MS, what accessible really means. Now, it's different in case to case, but generally speaking, how good do you think the public's understanding of different disabilities is, and how do we improve that education?
Well, you could call me at epiny.org, or, you know, call our offices, and we can certainly set up a time to talk and get that education and awareness out. But the thing about facing the challenges of the stigmas of disability is huge, and we got to get out there, and people in the community just need to be more open. You know, we've come a long, long way. Way back in the ancient era, in the early times, people with disabilities were, you know, just shipped away into these big asylums or institutions. And now that's not the way it is. People, you know, live in the community, whether it's with their families or in their own apartments or homes, with support. You know, we talked about integration with school, but same thing goes with businesses and agencies and people's homes. They can certainly be out there, per se, and live their life of their choosing with support.
Well, I think of Randy's story on his childhood and, you know, the different kinds of responses that kids would have. And I think of my own camp counselor days down on Chautauqua Lake, and how in the middle of my career, my middle of 5 years as a camp counselor, we decided to integrate what used to be Rotary Week. What became, well, there's kids with various abilities every single week. And, you know, 11, 12-year-olds, which can be a tough age, by the way, parents. We have middle school's tough, especially for boys. You know, we had boys in my cabin who at the first day might say, well, there's a child in a wheelchair, and is there any, you know, is anybody picking on this child? Is it a little awkward? But by the end of that week, invariably, those kids rallied around. They were all friends. They were very defensive of anybody else who might, you know, pick on a child. And I loved seeing that. Mm-hmm. And all it took was education and socialization. you know, just being there, just seeing and understanding it. Because what we don't understand can be difficult. It could be the other, and we can make assumptions. And I loved seeing that development. So I just appreciate the work that everyone here at the table does. And I'll wrap by asking this again: if you want to get involved, contact these various organizations, or just get more information, Mike, where would you send people?
The first place is our website, which is www.epiny.org. And you can see all of our list of our events and the contact information to get epilepsy education or access to our services. That's a great way. Our phone number is 585-442-4430, and that's one of our phone numbers for the local office. Plus, we have a Syracuse office and also down in Binghamton, too. So our agency is based within 22 counties of upstate and central New York.
That's great. And Carrie, once again, for the National MS Society Upstate New York chapter?
They can go online and locate their local chapter to volunteer through there. Yeah.
Awesome stuff. And Randy, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Carrie, to you as well. Continued success and good health. We appreciate your insight and your backgrounds and stories. And Mike Riddell, to you as well. Thanks for taking the time to come in and cap Dialogue and Disability Week. We appreciate all of you coming in here.
Thank you. Thanks
for having us.
Our thanks to John Andrus, the engineer today, and Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you've appreciated our various dialogues this week, and I've certainly learned a lot. Hope you have as well. Hope you have a nice weekend, and we'll be back with you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.